All right, this is the January 28th statutory interpretation class, and today we're picking up the continuing discussion on the federal legislative process. As always, quick look back. I wanted to highlight the things that were most important from our great class discussion on Monday. You guys did a wonderful job. Wanted to remind everyone that our focus here is to look at the federal legislative process, but with an emphasis of how we can approach it as advocates. I'm not asking you to become parliamentarians. I'm asking you to commit to memory House Rules 21 or senatorial rules. I am asking you to think about the process overall and where you, on behalf of your clients or on behalf of your interest, can intervene and help shape the progression of federal legislation. So with that in mind, we mapped out, in general, how the process worked. And we talked about the Civil Rights Act in particular on how it broke that process. So very briefly, running through, remember in the House, we actually had a very regimented, defined process that shaped and limited the way bills could proceed. They had to have a bill that was drafted. We talked about who drafted bills. We talked about then how the bills were introduced, and you had to have legislators who actually conveyed the bill to the Congress. Then at that point, the procedure kicked in because the speaker would choose which standing committee got the bill first. That choice had substantive implications. That choice was one that the persons who drafted the bill could shape and mold by the way they labeled and positioned the bill so it could be steered toward the committees whose jurisdiction covered it, but also would be favorably disposed towards the bill. We talked about the fact that the committee chair could then refer it further to a subcommittee, and that is where the real crucible of legislation begins, where the actual consideration and markup of the bill takes place. We'd have hearings. We'd then have a markup. During the markup, you'd actually have some express discussion of why terms are being changed, but oftentimes it's also opaque. Language might be offered to change a bill, and you may not know who, where, or how it came about. Then you'd have a report back from the subcommittee to the full committee, and then the full committee kicked it back to the House. And then again, a whole nother layer of machinery kicks in, namely the countering and the rules process. Remember, we had to have a rule to define how the legislation is going to be debated, how it's going to be considered. So that rules committee therefore takes up the next step of coming up with the best way to shape the House discussion. Essentially, there were six, once it is in the House Rules Committee, we talked about, again, civil rights legislation, ways that you can break the stranglehold a committee chair may have on a bill. Remember in the Rules Committee, Judge Smith wanted to kill the bill dead. He controlled the Rules Committee that would let the debate proceed. They had to force it out of his cold, clammy grip. The only way they could do that was with a discharge petition, remember the full vote of the majority of the House, or Calendar Wednesday, an archaic and rather entertaining way of, quaint, perhaps is the best word, procedure where each committee chair got up and announced that there were certain things that they wanted to have brought to the attention of the floor. And then last, a majority of the committee itself could essentially vote to force a hearing on a bill. That was the step that took place. So keep in mind that the committee's chair is powerful, but not all powerful. Once they get a rule passed out of the Rules Committee, once the bill is out of the full substantive committee, then you have to go to the House. And that's where the floor consideration begins. And we talked about first the House has to accept the rule for the bill. Then once the rule is accepted, the House dissolves and reforms itself into the Committee of the Whole. And essentially becomes a stripped down, streamlined version of the House for considerations and purposes of debate. At that point, you have discussion of the bill, and you can have unrecorded votes on amendments. Transparency, again, not being the highest premium. Once that debate is finished and the amendments are in place, then it would resume as the full House. And at that point, the minority member will move to recommit it. If the debate is concluded and the House is ready to pass it, that is routinely rejected, and then you have a full vote. Boom, finally, the end of this process. You're only halfway done. Because remember, there were stark differences between the House and the Senate. And the Senate does not have a lot of the same structural built-in procedural elements to try and shape and steer the way the debate takes place. Much more power is arrogated to individual senators. So instead of this complex rules and calendaring procedure in the Senate, the bill's read once. The bill's read twice, and opportunities are made for amendments at that point, and then it's referred to committee. Then once it's out of the committee, it's referred back to the Senate, and it's added to the senatorial calendars, and you just wait in line, unless there is a motion to consider the bill out of order. And unlike the House, with the Rules Committee, you have to have unanimous consent. One senator can jam the process and say, no, that bill stays where it is in line in the committee, the calendar, you cannot consider it in the out of order, and we may or may not get to by this session, but I'm not going to let you take it out of order. There, as a result, is two choke points. You can either have someone filibuster a motion to actually talk about the bill and move it up on the calendar, and then a filibuster on the actual bill itself. And we actually saw both of those with the Civil Rights Act. Now remember, also the Civil Rights Act, we saw a bit of a hijacking of the process. Remember, there was no committee consideration. Instead, it was voted directly or straight for consideration in the Senate, simply because they knew it was going to die a grisly death, given the committee chairs at the time at the Senate. That is another way to sort of navigate through this committee process. Once that is done, and you've had full senatorial consideration, you have a third reading and a vote on the bill as amended, and that's it. Next step, you've gotten one half done with the House, one half of the Senate. You have to really hope the two are identical, because you don't have law until they are exactly word for word the same. So either you have a conference committee, which we'll talk a little bit more about today, to try and harmonize the bills, or you just ask one other chamber to swallow its pride and just accept the other chamber's bill in whole and avoid conference committees and subsequent revotes, which is what happened with the Civil Rights Act. Whew. All right, that's a quick condensed summary of our hour and a half discussion on Monday. Any questions about that sort of high-level view of the process as it's supposed to typically work? Because today we're going to talk a little bit in more detail about how that process often now times doesn't work, and also how there are alternatives emerging to supplant some of this legislative process that you as lawyers wouldn't want to know about. I want to then walk you through an example that is happening as we sit in class. There's actually the first filibuster in the Senate for this congressional session taking place today. And then wrap up talking a little bit about the problem I'm asking you to think about that we'll discuss at the beginning of our class on Monday. All right? Okay. So with that in mind, what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about the normal federal legislative process and how the current implementation of it is evolving, some say mutating. If you will indulge me, this is going to be a little bit of more of a lecture, let's get through it portion of the class discussion, because I want to save some time for our discussion of the Keystone XL pipeline debate, which is what I mentioned earlier. So with that in mind, what I'd like to do is take the discussion and the text and try and give it to you in a schematic form that might make it a little bit easier to apply and implement, which is essentially, I want to talk about the life process of the bill, and particularly how it comes about. So think about in this way, we're going to be talking about a fact, a couple of takeaway things I want you to have in mind. And these are the sorts of things which, yes, would be on the final exam, most likely in the form of a question I'll ask you to apply these sorts of things. So first, practical concept number one about the legislative process at the federal level, it's designed to kill legislation. Most federal legislation is DOA. It is not going to see the light of day. 10,000 bills, at least, introduced every congressional session, the overwhelming majority of which are not going to ever have substantive legislative action taken on, and certainly will not become law. This process is designed that way. It intentionally makes it hard to get legislation in place. Both the dispersal of power among the different bodies of the legislature, as well as the powers among the federal government, which I know you're doing, Professor Turner, right now. So with that in mind, then, let's sort of talk about how the rules we have at least make it possible for that small subset of legislation to survive. The book points out that there is a very interesting hierarchy to keep in mind that might let you know which ones you need to pay attention to. The most important and fundamental rules that govern legislative process, the first are constitutional. And I've already referred to a couple of them. They've already played major roles in the case example of the Civil Rights Act. Example one, bicameralism. You have to have action by both houses. There is presentment. You have to present a unified, word-for-word, exactly the same bill from both chambers to the president for signature. You also have constitutional limits as to which chamber can consider which legislation. As we talked about on Monday, revenue bills have to come from the House. With that in mind, that's ironclad. That's the stuff you can't work your way around. You've got to satisfy. But past that point, things get a little murkier. Once you get past the constitutional skeleton, you get to then the law, what we'll call the law of House procedures and consent procedures, the rules. These are written down, black and white. If you have some time to kill and you're looking to sort of play some interesting mind games with yourself, actually take a look. They're online. The House rules and the Senate rules are actually fairly straightforward, fairly clearly written, and they will actually lay out, just the way you would have rules in a strategy game, how the process works. We've already run across some of them. For example, the senatorial rules set out in black and white exactly how a filibuster works and what sorts of requirements you need to satisfy to maintain one safely. Once you get past those official rules, and by the way, I should mention passing, the Senate rules are permanent. They can be modified from session to session. The House, interestingly enough, adopts new rules every congressional session. They recreate themselves anew, blinking in the sunlight. Realistically, they're largely the same, but there are opportunities for making more change to House rules than in Senate rules as a result of that. Then once you get past that constitutional base level and then the actual black and white rules of the process, then you get to what's basically custom, common law. You might as think as they call it folkways or folklore, the sort of unwritten code of proceeding in Congress. One of the most important of which used to be seniority. Seniority has now gotten to be a much more diluted thing, simply because, as we'll talk about in a minute, chairmanships are term limited. But nonetheless, seniority still plays an enormous role in terms of allocation of power, particularly in the Senate. So with those rules in place, let's sort of work our way through the process very quickly by just thinking of this as sort of certain stops along the way. And the first is what I'll just essentially call conception, how a bill becomes into existence in the first place. To think of that stop number one, and I will avoid any jokes or metaphors here because they just get me into trouble, especially since we're recording this lecture. But the conception of a bill simply means who writes the darn thing. And we talked about this in our last class. No limits. Anybody can write legislation. Anyone can draft a bill. That's not the choke point. The choke points are really twofold. One, who cares? Who sets the agenda as to what matters? And we mentioned this a little previously in our discussion about Selma. The president plays a key role in our current political posture on deciding which items are going to get on the agenda for consideration in Congress, even when an opposing party holds Congress. Second, you can write all the bills you want and it can match the agenda. It won't do you an iota of good unless you find a real live, breathing legislator to introduce it for you. That is a hard constitutional requirement. The federal system, only a legislator can bring a bill into existence by filing it. No other third parties. This legislative power is vested by the Constitution solely in Congress and its members. So once we've conceived the bill, the next step then is gestation, committee consideration. And again, very briefly, we talked a little bit about how this process works. Which committee gets it? Well, the Speaker delegates the committee. And the committee is usually a standing committee with jurisdiction over the topic of that bill. That's the high-level 10,000-foot answer we did on Monday. In truth, it's a lot more down in the weeds. I wish one of the persons I was hoping to get here who spoke with our class last year is the parliamentarian for the Texas legislature. The parliamentarian is a nonpartisan player in the legislative system. who is charged with essentially vetting and approving, well, I won't say approving, but offering opinions and advice as to where these allocations of committee assignments should go, which bills are going to the right committee. The parliamentarian makes this decision typically based on the existing rules creating the standing committees, but then also relies on precedent to sort of help guide that discretion. So as a result, the parliamentarian actually plays a fairly important, pivotal role. He's one of the most important people in the legislature no one ever hears about off the Hill. So once you've got that in mind, the chair has decided which committee it goes to the committee. And here, the other takeaway concept is the chair rules all. Enormous power goes to the chair. The chair can kill virtually most any bill by simply ignoring it and not scheduling it for hearing. Power of negation is the clause used in the book, but the truth is it just simply means the power of no. It just never sees the light of day. We've already talked about those three tools to break the deadlock. Remember what those were? Pause a moment to make sure their brain neurons are functioning. Oh no, people are looking it up. Yes. Yep. Exactly right. And I'm glad you were taking notes at the beginning of the class. That was perfectly done. I wish I had like a chocolate liqueur I could throw to you right now. Exactly right. Keep those in mind. Those tools are important because those are really the only tools in hand to break the omnipotence of a committee chair. But in addition, there are some other limits on that power of the chair that have evolved since the Civil Rights Act, particularly in the House. The one thing that I take away from here is thanks Newt Gingrich. And I should pause. You guys didn't. How many of you remember Newt Gingrich? Everybody? Yes. Good. I always where I make cultural references, and people give me these blank expressions like, "Wow, are you old?" But Newt's a fascinating character. But for our context today, his primary value is when he was Speaker of the House back in the Clinton years. He shepherded the Contract with America. Which was a wonderful document, but one of its key provisions was term limits for committee chairs. As a result, since that time, we're now getting to 20 years, every House committee chair is limited to 3 terms, 6 years. Didn't used to be that way. I remember committee chairs who literally sat chairing committees for 40 years. You want to talk about Wilbur Hayes and the House Ways and Means Committee. You have incredible power if you're there that long. No longer the case. Now, I don't want to make this all roses and bunnies playing in the field. What tends to happen is a committee chair will do 3 terms in one committee, then go to another committee, and then ends up back at the same committee. So you may actually see them circulating among committees. The power still remains fairly concentrated, but nonetheless, that's an important structural element that limits the power. Also, keep in mind, I specifically said the House. The Senate, committee chairs are not quite as powerful. Their ability to make a bill die a quiet, ignominious death in the shadows is not as sweeping. Why? Well, it's rather fundamental. Think back. When I was drawing these charts up here, when the House process, we had the Rules Committee, which defined how a debate will take place on a legislation. Part of that rule was that rule going to be open or closed or modified closed? In other words, can you offer amendments? And if you can't offer amendments, what kind of amendments? On this side of the board, the Senate doesn't have a Rules Committee. Therefore, there is no House or rule like in the House saying what amendments you can offer. You can offer anything as a senator. If someone's offering a bill to finance private space exploration, you can add a bill of what sort of egg inspections should be applied to organic chickens. Doesn't limit. Nothing there that stops the senator from doing that. So as a result, the committee chair's power to stop consideration of a bill is limited because you can basically resurrect it from the dead and offer an amendment to a relevant bill, or a bill that is not related to it. So, with that in mind, taking a quick breath, you can ask yourself a question, which I hope all of you ask, why are we talking about this? Why do we have committees in the first place? Again, I will resist my temptation to ask the trick question, which is, what provision of the Constitution mandates the use of committees? Because there ain't one. These are creatures of convention. They are the artifacts of history. That means there must be a reason for committees to exist. They must serve some valid purpose and useful function. Otherwise, why put up with them? Why give power to people? The short answers, again, sort of trying to condense this so we could talk about some other things later today, in your book, are actually fairly insightful. One of which is, and I think from my experience, is probably the more accurate one, informational. You will find that there is usually a close harmonization on committee chairs on topics that they know about or care about. Doctors heading up health subcommittees. You will find, for example, our representative in charge of the subcommittee on space has actually got an extensive aerospace background and actually has worked in the Air Force. That's because no congressperson can possibly know everything you need to know for legislation. It's just beyond the capacity of mortal kin. So as a result, informational allocation takes place where you essentially trust someone else to learn the issue and give you a good answer. That serves a valid function. It does create an odd situation where how do you oversee this process and make sure someone who is looking over something that you admit you know nothing about making the right call? And we see that tension played out a lot of times, and sometimes committees' power waxes to a point where you have to see pushback from the rest of the majority. But nonetheless, this informational role is critical. Oftentimes, you will see a unthinking vote by the majority of the congressional chamber because they trust the committee that looked at it to know what they're talking about. The other theory is we're cynical, and perhaps there's an element of this too. You will notice that a lot of committee chairs are held by legislators who have a vested interest in what that committee is ruling on. The committee that considers farm subsidy bills, well, if you're from a state with predominantly agricultural interests, you have a really overwhelming interest to be there, not because you know about it necessarily, but because you want to bring home those subsidies to your jurisdiction, to your district. So this is, it's called distributive, it's called rent-seeking, it's called work barrel, it's called all sorts of other charming terms. Bottom line is, it's a manipulation of political process to divert goods to a place where someone has a particularly strong interest and is willing to put themselves in to get them. Now, the third option is sort of a blend of those two. Simply, committees are tools of the majority party. And since the majority party in our history has tended to go back and forth between certain defined parties, the minority party has an interest in keeping the vestiges of the structure alive because they may be the majority the next term. So that tool perpetuates itself as a political convenience. But you'll notice all three of these theories don't exclude each other. You can have all three applied to exactly the same committees and have pretty constant answers on all three. It may explain why you see some votes that go a particular way that might surprise you. Particularly, there's a strong, in particular, distributed aspect of a particular bill. But nonetheless, they give you a good feel for why committees exist. From our perspective, why do we care about committees as lawyers? I've talked about this from a bit of a more of a legal theory perspective. I will simply say, again, in diplomatic terms, having worked with legislative groups in D.C., in law firms whose specialty is to advocate my interests on the Hill, committees are where it happens. You can talk with a legislator in advance about how to draft a bill. You can input on what that bill should say. But oftentimes, your client calls you because a bill is coming to existence that they want to strongly support, or by God, they want to kill it. And the place that action takes place is not on the floor, although it can. It's more difficult. It takes place in the committee, usually during the markup session, usually in the context where you are working with staffers who hear your concerns and can offer language that are responsive to your client's interests if the legislator is willing, in good faith and exercise of their constitutional duties, to do that. Why? Well, quite frankly, the bill is still at a malleable stage at that point. Interests haven't frozen yet. You haven't had the situation where the trades have been made and people want to keep that language the way that they've agreed to keep it because they've given up something for it. Frankly, it's less transparent. You're not seeing recorded votes on all the changes necessarily. You're not seeing exactly what's taking place behind the curtain. So the ability to talk with someone about interest is a little bit less constrained. Whether that's good or bad, I leave to your evaluation, but it's, I think, an objective fact. It also has an important output that we care about as lawyers. And the last reason we care about committees is the paper they create, namely their reports. I mentioned this previously, and I'm sorry, I actually have a report on my desk in my office I meant to bring to you, but these legislative reports are essentially roadmaps that spell out exactly the official reasons why this committee has recommended this bill in this particular way. They can refer to the hearings testimony from hearings that held previously, but the report actually walks through, typically, the section-by-section review of the legislation and gives why that legislation is written that way, what it's targeting to address, what the strategy that's selected makes sense to do. As a result, when we get to our next part of this class, statutory interpretation, you're going to see legislative reports as an incredibly important tool. You'll also find they're incredibly controversial because, think about it again as lawyers, if you want to make sure a bill is crafted in a way to achieve your client's interest and you want to make sure a future court respects that, legislative history becomes a tool. It becomes a tool to wield, to shape, to modify, to direct. As a result, a lot of legislative history is not written as an objective report, it's written for a purpose. Judges know that. And you will find, in particular, in the cases we read in the next couple of weeks, dialogues with Justice Scalia, Justice Stevens, and Justice Breyer on what role legislative history should play, if at all, given its instrumental nature and its questionable veracity in some respects if you feel that the person is trying to manipulate the judicial process. All right, so we've talked about inception, gestation, let's keep going, and now talk about what I'll just, the most awkward metaphor I can offer here is scheduling your induced labor. You've gotten through baking the bill in the committee, now the next stage is, well, you got to get to the floor. You've got to get it calendared. So adding to the calendar, I threatened briefly to mention this in our last class, and I will briefly mention it, but it's not just a calendar. Each chamber has multiple calendars. For our purposes, the one that I really strongly just suggest you want to focus on is, on the House side, the union calendar. The union calendar is the big calendar. It's the omnibus calendar. Everything goes to the union calendar except certain special bills. In particular, there is a House calendar for the Rules Committee changes. And there's also a private calendar for private legislation. The odds of those crossing your path, unless you're a specialist in lobbying or legislative procedure, are fairly minimal. The odds that your clients are going to have a bill on the union calendar at some point in your career are fairly high. Bless you. Marcella?
Yes.
Okay. Consent calendar. Consent calendar is the grease that keeps the wheels rolling. It's for the minor stuff. Usually bills less than $1 million, usually bills that everyone expects to pass unanimously, the stuff that's just the workaday grist of the legislative mill. And those usually get passed unanimously at the end of the day. There's also a discharge calendar for discharge petitions. Again, rarely invoked, but can be important. Those are the calendars that sort of keep the trains rolling forward. Keep in mind, though, you can preempt the whole thing by moving to suspend the rules. I've got a special bill. It deserves more consideration right away ahead of all these other bills. Move me to the front of the line. The Rules Committee can do that, but you can also move to suspend the rules and move to consider a bill in expedited fashion. It's particularly important. Now there's a quid pro quo. You give up something to go to the front of the line. Namely, you can't amend it. You've got to be really sure you got this bill where you need it to be. The other thing is, you've got to have 2/3 vote for it. So you're not quite consent calendar, but you're not too far away. These are for bills that are important, but everyone unanimously agrees that it should proceed. You may have some opposition, but not enough to overrule it. You can move forward that way. All those calendars, so I've mentioned 5 different calendars plus a different way to circumvent the calendars, are all on the House side. which again is probably helping you get the sense that the House is a bit more fractious and messy place. The Senate, on the other hand, just has two. And all we really talk about primarily there is the calendar of general orders. That's where most of the action happens. The executive calendar is really for things like treaties and appointments by the White House. And I've had many a friend languish for many months on the executive calendar, waiting to get some confirmation. It's probably one of the most dysfunctional aspects of the Senate right now. All right, so keep in mind, those are the calendars, but you can always bump up on the calendars by getting a House rule. And we've talked about the Rules Committee. Keep in mind, you can always get unanimous consent in the Senate to bump up. But if you get one person objecting, you have to have a debate on that motion to proceed out of order. Now, I promise we talk a little bit about how some of the rules have changed since our discussion of the Civil Rights Act. I'm sorry, I'm just barreling ahead. You need to wave your hand back and forth.
Sorry, I just didn't get the second calendar for the Senate.
Well, the executive calendar?
The Senate
calendar. In the Senate. It's an executive calendar. It's a Senate calendar that's called the executive calendar, which I admit is confusing. It's not a White House calendar. It's a calendar in the Senate called the executive calendar. Yeah, but that's the reason they call it the executive is because it deals with matters predominantly in the executive branch, like treaties or executive appointments. But good question. Any others? All right. Changes. The most important ones are these. Cloture, killing that filibuster, stopping it, does not require 66 votes anymore. You only need 60. Keep that in mind. It's going to be relevant when we talk about our example here in a few minutes. Example number two, filibusters are limited. You can filibuster in the Senate now for substantive legislation and Supreme Court nominations. Your filibuster capabilities are more limited in terms of other appointments at lower levels in the federal government. That was a conscious, controversial, recent change pushed through by the 114th Congress, last session by Majority Leader Harry Reid, because frankly the process had broken down. Yes?
Sorry, what were the two things against substantive and?
How far back are we going?
Oh, just like 2 seconds for the Senate, the things you're able to filibuster.
Substantive legislation and Supreme Court appointments, nominations. It's a scary thing when you ask me to remember something from 30 seconds ago and I have to struggle. What did I just say? Any other questions? By the way, yes?
So I know that they can filibuster presidential nominations that aren't to the Supreme Court. Well, what would be the opposite of substantive legislation here? Like, what is the non-substantive legislation which they would not be able to filibuster?
Well, first of all, that call gets to be made on legislation on a case-to-case basis. But generally, think of stuff like the House of Consent. Fairly small stakes, the kind of stuff that's routine. But there is no formal definition as to what is a substantive or non-substantive legislation.
Something like the calendar, you said?
Or like the consent calendar, perhaps, where you have bills for less than $1 million that everyone expects to pass unanimously. Yeah, that's easy. Why filibuster that? Well, in the past, those kinds of bills have been held up as hostages for other legislation. You can't do that now.
Is that a consent calendar is in the Senate as well?
No. No consent calendar in the Senate.
Okay. So
that's just an example of what the type of bill you'd say.
Okay, I got you.
Okay.
And
clear? All right, calibration. You can still hear me in back. And I'm not going too fast. All right. Okay. So now we've gotten through inception, gestation, we've scheduled delivery, now the big moment, the birth itself. And here we're talking about floor consideration. And as opposed to birth, which half this class will experience in traumatic fashion, the Congress, it's fairly routine. Floor debate is not the stuff of drama that you will see in the movies. Usually floor debate is C-SPAN. And I'll pause here. I know some folks here have actually worked in the legislature, so I will try not to say anything too derogatory. But how many of you have actually watched C-SPAN? And what was your impression in terms of the house-pounding entertainment value of that? Louder?
Minimal.
Minimal, as in?
Bland.
If I keep waving my hands, I think you'll work your way down from boring to excruciating. Fair, okay. Most floor debates are not debates. They are essentially statements offered on the floor that can be used by that particular member of Congress for future purposes, but they're not designed to persuade other Congress members. You'll see most of them take place on empty floors or with very few congressmen around them. What they do, though, is they create a legislative record. It's recorded in the congressional record. As a result, some of those statements, which were totally ignored and were so horrific when they took place, are nonetheless important for us as lawyers when we're fighting about what those words mean in court, particularly if the sponsor of that legislation offers a statement in court. The sponsor offers a statement on the floor. So, you'll see variations of this kabuki play. You will see two Congress members engage in what's called a colloquy. This is not an actual conversation. This is essentially a script where one Congress member will say something and ask a question to another Congress member, and they respond not for any purpose other than to create a dialogue in the congressional record that can be used to haggle over the meaning of that bill in the future. Again, instrumental, conscious use of legislative history to shape the way the judicial system and future administrative agencies apply the law. Notice you can have colloquies by persons other than the sponsors. Parties who hate this bill and want it dead can offer a colloquy and say what they think this bill means. It's in the record, it's part of the legislative history, it may be relevant to a court's interpretation of it. But there are still some opportunities for things to happen. Not in the debate, not in the colloquies, not in the planted, frankly, testimony you'll see in congressional records. Oftentimes, if you read the congressional record, you'll notice there's a little bullet. It simply means they never said it. They sent it in typed version of the congressional record and say, put it in as if I said it. It's still part of legislative history. Where it matters is when you have votes on amendments. You can have amendments on the floor, and that's where the rubber hits the road. There are all sorts of amendments. There are all sorts of ways to call them. The bottom line is that for our purposes, I'll just simply broadly categorize them as friendly amendments designed to make the bill better. Those are common, those are routine, those are often accepted in large vote majorities. And then hostile amendments. And the hostile amendments are oftentimes the most bitterly fought. You can also have amendments that are not amendments. They're effectively amendments to substitute an entirely different bill in place of the legislation. And you'll recall, that's exactly what happened with the Civil Rights Act. With the Civil Rights Act, the creature that emerged from the House was gone on the Senate and entirely replaced by a doppelganger, a changeling put in the crib, because another bill drafted by Dirksen was put in place that essentially supplanted it. Those type of amendments are called amendments in the nature of a substitute. Essentially, think of it as a nuclear bomb amendment. Now, that is not a substitute amendment. The book sort of makes a haggling point on that. I'll just simply say a substitute amendment means I had an amendment, now I'm substituting another one to replace that amendment. Amendment in the nature of a substitute means wipe the board clean, I'm putting a new bill up in place. All that can happen on the floor. All that usually is fairly transparent because you have to have a movement to show that is putting that amendment into play. Yes?
Explain the difference between a substitute amendment and the nature of a substitute
amendment. Sure. A substitute amendment is easy, routine. It simply says, I have an amendment, and I don't like it anymore, so I'm replacing that amendment with a different one. Instead of saying or, I'm going to say the. So I'm substituting that amendment to make clear. An amendment in the nature of a substitute is basically taking that entire bill and saying, after the first sentence, erase it. Amendment in the nature of substitute means you're substituting an entirely different bill in its place, essentially. Okay, any other questions in that respect? All right, so home stretch. We've been talking about this is the process of birth. We've now gotten, we've gotten through how the floor debates take place, the nature of amendments. We could talk a little bit about how the counts take place on the floor, but I think, frankly, the most important thing you just need to know are you can't, bless you, lots of sneezing today. You can't vote unless you have a quorum. Once you have the quorum, all you need is a majority on the federal level. So, federal level, you just need a majority of a quorum. That's not always the case. Some legislatures require a majority of the actual voting members available. So you can have a quorum, but you still need to round up bodies to get yourself up to a majority of the overall legislative body. That sounds like a picky minor point. Think about the implications. You may be the minority party and you can't stop a bill. You don't have a prayer, but you have car keys and you can take your fellow compadres and head out of town. Bless you again. And essentially bring the legislative machinery to a grinding halt. This may sound a bit like a road movie, but the truth is it's happened here in Texas. We've actually had the legislature shut down when the Democratic minority decamped, fled to Oklahoma, because they wanted to preclude consideration of certain bills by the Republican majority. They actually requested that the Sergeant of Arms of the legislature go out and find them. And the Texas Rangers were trying to find these hiding legislators. So it can happen. It's one of those quirks that has real-world consequences. Unfortunately, no such amusement of value at the capital and the federal level. We just need to have a quorum. Okay, so now we're at the tail end of the process. We've had the birth. Unfortunately, now we may have to do a little cleanup on the baby, namely this the conference committee. And essentially here, the key things, we've already talked about the conference committee, but just to add to them, here's where the committee chair comes back to haunt you. Better not have offended this person, because the committee chair typically nominates the conference members. How would you like to be the congressman who blasted a bill from a hostile chair using a majority vote or a discharge petition, even worse, on the floor of the House, and suddenly find out that same House chair that you basically outmaneuvered is picking the persons to actually deliver your baby to the world? Committee chairs are very powerful people. And also, keep in mind, I think that's literally six sneezes in the past 4 minutes. I'm curious, is anyone here, are we having flu here at the law school?
Yeah.
Really? Is someone here? No? No, yes, a few. Let's be careful. I mean, there's actually an advisory that we're in an endemic flu situation right now in Texas. But I've not heard about people in the law school yet getting it, but it starts happening.
Sorry? Yeah, it's going around, especially in the section.
I'm hearing some shadow of water here. All right. Here's the next question I came to say. How many of you have actually had your flu shots? Really? Okay. I'm inspired. I will get my flu shot this weekend. Hold me to it. Sorry? Oh, really? Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, then I'll give my next lecture wearing a gauze mask and rubber gloves. That's really depressing. Okay. Last step. Then we can get to Keystone XL. Name. Oh, sorry.
I was wondering if the committee chair could leave off the sponsor of the bill.
On the conference chair?
Yeah.
The conference committee?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
It's frankly, it's rare, but it's possible. Which, if you think about it, is the ultimate way to slip the blade in. Any other questions? You can see these rules are designed for all sorts of passion plays behind the curtain. All right, we've had the conference committee now. Now it goes to the president. And here it's fairly straightforward for what we need to talk about now. We'll get into the president's role in legislation a little bit later. We'll talk about central interpretation principles. The key things here, 10 days. Flashing fingers here. 10 days. That's the amount of time the president has to either sign it or return it without signature to the Congress or veto. Now notice I said return it without signature. If the president doesn't sign it but just lets it sit on the desk because she's busy that week, that becomes law. You actually have either an affirmative veto or you have to return it unsigned. But inaction, the default is it becomes law. lot of people forget that because it's not that way on the legislative level for states. But important exception here, and now we're probably going back to Schoolhouse Rock for a lot of you. The pocket veto. I thought about playing it today. I decided not to.
You should, yeah.
Maybe next class. All right. I actually, the reason I did is I was worried none of you had actually seen Schoolhouse Rock. I thought it was like an artifact. Really?
Yes.
How many of you have actually seen Schoolhouse Rock? It lives. Okay. All right, next class, we'll have that, just because I think it'd be kind of a fun way to get things going on a Monday morning. Pocket vetoes. If your congressman is foolish enough to send a bill to the White House that the White House hates, and there's only 9 days left in the session, the president can sip lemonade and watch it die. Pocket veto. Inaction in that context means the bill does not become law, because it happens within that frame of 10 days before the end of the congressional session. 11 days, on that 11th day, when he doesn't sign or she doesn't sign, it becomes law. But if it's less than 10 days, that default mechanism does not have an opportunity to work. Okay? All right. One final point. It's a sore point for most presidents. No line item veto. Professor Turner will probably go into this with gruesome detail with you because it's been the subject of recent Supreme Court jurisprudence. There have been attempts to give the president the ability to veto particular parts of legislation, pick and choose. Not the case on the federal level. It's either all or nothing. The president must veto the entire bill or accept it. They can't excise out the objectionable portions, which means those Christmas tree amendments in the Senate of non-germane legislation, he has to swallow the bitter with the sweet. Okay? Yes?
Can the president, through the executive order, regarding legislation?
In what way? I mean, it's a fascinating idea.
I mean, I don't know. He could make an executive order that says this section of this law just passed by Congress is void. Is that, would that amount to a line item, I guess?
Well, at the risk of stealing our thunder for later in the semester, there are two ways. One is a signing statement. The president, just like Congress, can create legislative history. So let's say, for example, president thinks that this bill is a good idea, but there's a particular provision of it that's unconstitutional. She can sign a signing statement saying, this bill overall is effective, but I believe this particular portion of it is unconstitutional. But I am signing it nonetheless because it's not important enough to prevent the overall message of the bill. The second is an executive order, which basically exercises discretion of enforcement. The president can say, we are going to decline to enforce this particular portion of the bill in these particular circumstances. Similar to the DREAM Act, the idea that you can flexibly exercise enforcement discretion. Hotly contested whether or not constitutionally that satisfies the duty to exercise, to execute the laws of good faith. But nonetheless, theoretically, an executive order could do that. Fabulous question, by the way. Any others? Yes?
Sorry to take us back. How the conference committees are established, right, so the committee chairs are involved?
Well, the ultimate way is that the speaker or majority leader actually chooses the conference committees. Each one of the conference committee. But they usually go off a list of nominees presented by the chair of the committee that had the bill last.
Okay, gotcha.
Okay? All right. So that's the process, beginning to end. Any other questions about it before we apply it to what's happening? I wish we could put C-SPAN up here. We could actually see what's happening in the Senate right now. All right, very quickly, gauging how quickly we can, how far in the debate we can jump in. How many of you are familiar with the Keystone XL debate? I'm hoping most hands will go up here. All right, let me give you, if this will work, actually, there's a standby button, but there we go. Give it a second to warm up. Keystone XL. it up yet? All right, it's coming up in a second. While it's warming up, Keystone XL is a pipeline. It is a pipeline that serves one purpose. It crude oil from Alberta, Canada, to the Gulf Coast of the United States. It is very controversial for multiple reasons. Most importantly, one, the oil we're talking about is not oil. It's actually called bitumen. It's an extremely heavy grade crude that is actually not liquid. Sorry, it's clipped a little bit at the top, but what you'll see is it starts up north. The current line is to go through Nebraska and hook up in Cushing, Oklahoma, and then continue down to the Gulf Coast and actually refine here. We're getting this crude bitumen. The reason people care about it is if you take a look at how it's generated, you don't pump it, you mine it. You have to actually excavate this rock, which looks effectively like coal or hard shale, and chemically treat it to extract this heavy, dense bitumen, and then make it a liquid you can pump through a pipeline. It has devastating effects in the landscape, but the real reason it generates so much opposition is that it creates an enormous amount of greenhouse gases compared to regular oil, because you have to use a lot of energy to get this bitumen out of the ground. Now, I gave you my oath we would not make this an environmental class. It's hard to resist sometimes. But there is an international element here. If you go back to the route of the pipeline, the most important part is right there. It crosses national boundaries. As a result, the current existing law mandates that it must have a permit from the White House authorizing in the national interest the construction of a transnational pipeline. That's the heart of it. The White House must issue the permit for the northern portion of this pipeline to be constructed. I'll point out, this part is already constructed. They finished it. TransCanada has done this line. TransCanada is the company building the Keystone XL pipeline. Side note, for those of you who are interested, TransCanada's headquarters in the United States is here in Houston. And they actually are looking for attorneys to work on this project. Now, having said that, the White House, because environmental groups are virulently opposed to the idea of developing these tar sands that have such a large greenhouse gas impact, has essentially tried to kill it through benign neglect. So for many years, we've had environmental impact statements that have lasted for many years in the review process. Those are done. But now we have a permit that's still sitting at the Department of State that's not been issued. For years, this stalemate's played out. I am not in any way endorsing this pipeline. I'm not in any way opposing this pipeline, presenting it to you as a legislative consideration. In the past, up until January of this year, we've had a Democratic Senate. Efforts to try and force the White House to let go of this permit have failed. As a matter of fact, they've never even made it to the White House to be vetoed. The president has never, until recently, been put in a position where he had to say yes or no. That has now changed. We are now in a situation where the legislative constituency has changed in light of the last midterm elections. And here are the critical numbers. We now have 54 Republican senators out of 100. We now have, to be precise, 247 Republicans out of 435. The first bill filed in the Senate was a bill to dislodge the Keystone XL pipeline terminal. I attached it to your email that I sent out for this class. You'll notice it's shockingly brief, 6 pages, the bulk of which is margins. The operative provision is a couple of pages long. Essentially says, this pipeline is approved. And the president, the environmental impact statement is sufficient. You can't sue over it, unless it's in the DC circuit, so you can't sue in state court or any other place in the country. And this is the bill that currently is now in the Senate. Now I'll pause here. take a breath. Pull up your short-term and long-term memories now. If we were approached by someone who wanted to get this bill approved, we obviously have to think about strategy in the Congress. If we were approached by parties who wanted to kill it dead, we've talked about that as well. What I'd like to do is start with the latter. Assume we want to stop the pipeline. I'm just choosing it because it helps highlight where you can take advantage of the legislative process as advocate. We have a House with the numbers I just described, the party that has come out publicly in favor of the pipeline. We have a Senate, but also the majority of that party. What is the most likely pathway that we can use to stop the pipeline at this point? So who would like to be the Democratic strategist opposing this bill?
I'll do it.
You sure? I was about to call some other hapless soul.
Do it on our side.
Okay.
Sure. So where's the bill at right now?
Let's just assume right now we've got a clean slate. We've got bills that have been written, they have been filed, but nothing else has happened in both chambers. We want to stop both. What's our best use of resources?
Well, if there's nothing happened yet, I guess we don't really need to do anything, but if there's anything proposed in the Senate, we can filibuster it. We have the executive, so he can veto it a number of ways. If it's in less than 10 days, he just doesn't have to take any action on it. But he's publicly said he'll veto it, so if they actually were to pass it, I think he would go ahead and veto it.
So, and I don't want to distort what you're saying. Your initial reaction is, wait.
Yes,
wait. See what develops. Jump in when there's something.
Because if I'm the Democratic strategist, we're the minority party.
Right.
So the tools that we have are mainly obstructionist, right? Obstructionist tools. So we have to kind of wait to see what they do and then react and try to use some procedural methods, most likely to just try to kill the bill.
Okay.
They have all the committee chairs, stuff like that. All
right. Are you coming to save the bill? Or?
Well, I have a question. Sure. So what would be the political makeup of the committee that actually has jurisdiction over this review force?
Which one would you like it to be? Which strategist?
Well, I would like it to be probably Democrat, as a Democratic strategist. I would want the committee to be Democratic. I don't know how realistic that would be, considering it's such a hot topic. Get some pressure from people that are maybe trying to work in the middle.
Well, the sad but gruesome truth is, by definition, every single committee is going to be dominated and headed by Republican. So to a certain extent, which committee seems to be a way you can steer towards to get a favorable result as a Democrat? And I don't mean to jump ahead to your answer here, but I'm not sure where the pathway toward is in the House.
I guess there's an environmental subcommittee or committee of some type, and even if they're chaired by the Republican, I would hopefully assume that they would be
one question. You hear in the back row? They're all shaking their heads.
I would assume, hopefully, that if a Republican was the head of a committee, that they would at least be for the environment, or would they perhaps be the head of it and not for it?
Okay, very valid point. His comment was maybe the environmental committee would be more likely to be in favor of, say, rather than an energy committee or a trade committee. In the Senate, the head of essentially the environmental subcommittee is Jim Inhofe from Oklahoma. I hear knowing chuckles in the back row on the other side. Let's just simply say our prospects aren't bright with Jim. I'll stop there.
If I was trying to get it to pass, I'd start looking at which senators, if there's any Democratic ones where the pipeline runs through, is there going to be under a lot of pressure by their constituents probably to pass it and come up with some good pork barrel amendments to stick on there that maybe they can get their support against it? And I'd do the same thing for Republicans. I try to see if I can maybe trade votes with them once more.
I hate to ask this, I should remember, I'm still getting everyone's names and histories down, but do you have a legislative background?
No.
Because that's an incredibly insightful way to handle the situation. It jumps ahead of our discussion to a certain extent, which we're trying to think of ways to stop it. You're already figuring out ways to wire around our opposition, namely find a breakaway Democratic vote that we can peel away to add to, and I'm assuming as well, particular roadblocks. Yes?
Well, if you're talking about stopping it and you're going to look at constituents, wouldn't actually the people who are going to be near the pipeline be most likely to be adverse to, because they're the ones that are going to have the direct environmental disadvantage, because it's going to be affecting the land right around them. Especially if you're going through like the middle of the country where there's a lot of land and, I mean, a lot of crops and whatnot, they're going to, I mean, that's going to have a huge effect on them if it's affecting the soil and the air and everything.
That's also a great answer. It's also, that starts with a complement to your answer. Find peel-away votes who will support stopping it, who might otherwise be traditional Republican steadfast for it, because it's going through Nebraska, farms and cornfields. It's going through Kansas, deepest Republicans could possibly be, but when it's your yard being dug up and your crops being displaced, your perspective can change. So basically, the strategy here is we're looking a little bit over the curve of the horizon and planning out how we can peel away votes away from party lines. But it sounds like that's because you're expecting a certain vote and a certain type of action, which I'm assuming you guys are thinking about filibustering. Or are you thinking about majority votes? Or am I putting thoughts into your heads that are unfair?
I wasn't really thinking about the filibuster.
Okay. What were you thinking about?
Just analyzing.
All counting, you're right. You find the ones that you think you can pull over to your side of the ledger, and you go after one by one by one, and you build a coalition. But that's a very tactical answer. And again, I want to show the utmost respect for Professor Kumar, because I know she likes to have a little time to get ready for class, so I'm going to nudge us ahead a little bit. Let me ask some fundamental strategic questions that might guide our thinking here. If you only had the resources to fight this battle once, which chamber makes the most sense to focus on? Everyone says Senate in a quiet way. You should say it with vim and vigor, because that's your hope. You may be the rump tail of the session, the minority party with no hope of getting anything pass. But you've got the Senate, you've got the filibuster, where you don't need a majority to win. On the House side, what are our prospects of stopping it? Well, let's face it, the Speaker picks the committee. The committee chair has control over it. If you even force a dislodge of a bill or try to change terms of the bill, you get overriding majority votes. It's looking pretty grim. And frankly, that's what's happened. The House, it's gone straight through. We already have Keystone Bill in the House. The Senate, that's where it gets interesting. Remember, read once, read twice, referred to the committee. Out for consideration, and then to take it out of order, you've got to have unanimous consent. And then you have to have a substantive debate. We had the first filibuster of our new Congress on Keystone in the Senate, because that's where the power lies. I will pause because I want to do justice to your comments. Both of you made great comments, because exactly what you suggested is what's happened. There have actually been peel-aways of Democratic votes, because people need jobs. The pipeline going through their district is viewed as important. People also publicly backed the pipeline in the past because they view it as an energy security issue. They'd much rather get the vision of Canada than having a ship from Venezuela. You can work on those and sort of create an ad hoc coalition that breaks open party lines, but you've got to have enough to break the 60-vote barrier. Just to sort of perhaps cut a little bit to the end here, as you can tell, since I said that the filibuster is still continuing, it's obviously not there yet. They've actually had midnight marathon sessions where the Democrats have offered amendment after amendment after amendment to the Keystone Bill. They've been objected to the fact that the majority leader is trying to limit debate on some of those provisions to only a certain amount of time. They're saying they should have the right to open amendment of the legislation. At this point, as we speak, 18 amendments are being offered in the Senate floor this morning. The most substantive amendments to this bill then was offered in the entire congressional session last year to try to make it acceptable for passage by the Democrats. The odds are, given the degree of control, they had a 59 vote in favor of the bill earlier this week. It's going to pass, despite the filibuster, despite the rules favoring allocation of property. All the tactics and strategy we're talking about work enough. It's going to pass, though, with multiple Democratic amendments on things that aren't necessarily related just to Keystone, but lots of other Christmas tree options. So, with that in mind, what's the next step? We're trying to kill this bill dead. I hear quiet murmurs from the side here. Who do you go to? The bill has now been signed. Let's assume it's also unanimously exactly the same on both sides of the hill.
Well, yeah, ideally you want to keep, if you're opposing it, you want to keep that vote. It's going to get to 60, but you want to keep it below 67 so that when it goes to the president, he can veto it, and then when it comes back, they can't overrule it.
Brilliant. And the president's already threatened to veto it. It was his first veto threat of the new congressional session. That was the threat. Now, though, he's faced with a bill that actually has some realistic Democratic support. Keep in mind, as we'll talk a little bit later next week, there may be limits on the ability for the president to veto legislation, especially if the Senate has the ability to amend that legislation to add other things the president needs. The president's ability to veto legislation may also be limited if there's a bill that's got to pass, but someone in the Senate in particular has inserted a provision that's repellent, but the president is again forced to have to choose between vetoing the entire bill or just swallowing hard and accepting that repellent provision. So Keystone, that's where we're at. By next week, we will probably have a Keystone bill. My guess is that it will be going to the White House shortly after that. Let me give you a small coda before we break. This may all be lights and smoke. This again is not me arguing in favor of the pipeline or against it. But while all the attention has been focused on this as a climate change avatar, another pipeline's been built. It's a pipeline called Seaway. Seaway runs from Cushing down Texas. It is connected with a woman that's called, I'm trying to remember the name of it now, Alberta Clipper. The Alberta Clipper pipeline crosses, was already in place before Keystone was ever proposed. They basically expanded that pipeline and now hooked it up. So keep in mind, a lot of times the fight is more about the political appearances than the actual reality. We may already be getting bitumen in the Gulf Coast this year. Keystone may never get approved. Nonetheless, those wheels tend to find their way. With that deeply pessimistic and depressing thought, any questions, comments, or ideas? All right, for next week, we're going to start with the Duke Power example at the end of our readings today, and then talk about the cases that developed after that. The pages we're going to be reading, and I'll send this to you by email, are pages 61 through 80. We're going to be trying to wrap up the federal legislative process in the next week or so, and then we're going to talk about the Texas legislative process. And from there, once we have firmly those in hand, we'll start talking about statutory interpretation with that content behind. Anything else before we break for the weekend? All right, come to the free lunch if you can. Otherwise, have a great weekend. Enjoy the weather.